and welcome to The Europeans, your weekly shot of European stories delivered right into those ear canals of yours.
It's so weird that you use this metaphor because I've actually just decided to lean into my French identity this week and squirt a bunch of saline solution into my orifices.
What?
Because I have a cold. Sorry, did I not mention that?
Oh, but also into your ears?
Yeah, because they're blocked. But I'm really curious, is it just in France where people like shoot saline solution into their ears and eyes and everything else when they have colds? Or is it everywhere?
I really don't know. I've only ever heard about shooting saline solution into your nose, which I think is quite sensible, although you have to be careful when you've got a cold, right? Because it can also make things worse.
It could go horribly wrong. I don't know. But anyway, my French friend who I was talking about this to, she actually has like a little mini teapot that you can use just for this purpose. There's like a whole industry around it here.
A neti pot.
A what pot?
It's called a neti pot, right?
I have no idea. All of this is new to me. Anyway, how are you? This is not where I thought we were going to start this week's podcast.
I'm fine. I'm also, yeah, pretty bunged up, I guess, like most people in Europe at this time of year.
Get yourself some saline solution, people.
We are not sponsored by the neti pot. Actually, we're clearly not sponsored by the neti pot because you don't even know what it is.
Neti pot. I'm just going to Google it. Neti pot. Yes, this thing. Okay, well, I take it back. It's not a French thing, but it is something I'm trying. Anyway, speaking of orifices.
Speaking of orifices. Well, not exactly speaking of orifices, but yeah, last week we took a deep dive into the biggest geopolitical developments that have happened in Europe around the summer. This week, we're going to the other end of the spectrum of topics that we could talk about on this show. And we're talking about testicles.
Yay! We don't talk enough about testicles on this podcast.
We really don't. We're going to be finding out about a DIY method of male contraception that I think it's fair to say hasn't hit the mainstream just yet, but maybe it'll have a chance in the coming feminist utopia, who knows. It's called the thermal method or heat-based contraception, a technique that involves carefully tucking away those testicles back into the body for 15 hours a day.
So cozy.
I have to say, when I spoke to some people about this, they didn't even realize it was possible, including some people with testicles, which I was quite surprised about. But anyway, much more talk about testicles later in the show. That's coming up in our interview segment after Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who has had a good week, Dominic?
It's been a good week for taking a stand against the far right in Italy, because in a rather surreal turn of events, the granddaughter of Italy's fascist dictator Benito Mussolini, a councillor called Rachele Mussolini, made the big decision to leave Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's Brothers of Italy party because she thinks it's too right-wing.
Huh.
Rachele Mussolini is a city councillor in Rome, and she announced this week that she would be moving to the Forza Italia party, also a right-wing party, and a party that I should note nationally is in coalition with Meloni's party. But Forza is, at least on some issues, more liberal than Meloni's Brothers of Italy, which, yeah, some academics describe as far-right, some say hard-right or radical-right. But I'm going to stick with far-right today because that's what my go-to populism expert, Cas Mudde, uses when he talks about Meloni and Brothers of Italy. He says that we should use far-right even though she supports Ukraine in the war. Like, that doesn't mean that she's not far-right on other issues.
Fair enough.
Anyway, what is clear is that the party was too extreme for Rachele Mussolini. She said to the ANSA news agency that, quote, "It is time to turn the page and join a party that I feel is closer to my moderate and centrist sensibilities."
Okay, so she's moving to Forza Italia. That is the party of former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, right?
Yes.
So, like, not necessarily the home of moderate and centrist sensibilities, as she describes?
I see where you're going with this, yes. Good point. But I think it's fair to say Rachele Mussolini is definitely more centrist than Meloni, especially on civil rights issues. And Forza is definitely more centrist than Brothers of Italy. Rachele herself takes a much more progressive position on LGBTQ plus rights, also on abortion and also on the rights of children of migrants. Whereas Meloni, as we've discussed many times on this show before, is passing laws that make life really difficult for LGBTQ plus people in Italy, and especially really difficult for migrants.
Yeah, absolutely. Remind me, because there is some history here. How is Meloni's party, Brothers of Italy, connected historically to the political movement of Benito Mussolini, the former dictator?
And Rachele's grandfather. The Brothers of Italy, it's often described as post-fascist because its foundations can be traced back to the Italian Social Movement, which was a party that was formed by members and supporters of Mussolini's regime. And it's not exactly a history that's like very deeply hidden. You don't have to dig too far to find those traces of this fascist history. I mean, for example, just look at the logo. The logo of the Brothers of Italy party contains a flame with the three colours of the Italian flag in it. This exact same flame was also the logo of the neo-fascist Italian social movement. Mm. And Meloni herself has a history of praising Mussolini. There is that famous clip of Meloni in a French interview from when she was 19, in which she described Benito Mussolini as a good politician, saying that there have been no politicians like him in 50 years.
Mm. Moi, je crois que Mussolini c'était un bon politicien. C'est-à-dire que tout ce qu'il a fait, il a fait pour l'Italie.
I should also say that she has since rejected her fascist past and the fascist past of her party and tries to present herself and her party as a mainstream right-wing party. But meanwhile, she has chosen not to change the logo, which clearly has fascist connections and is clearly drawing on support from people who celebrate Mussolini's fascist legacy. There was actually a pretty shocking undercover investigation over the summer from the Italian outlet Fanpage, which showed members of the youth branch of her party shouting fascist and Nazi slogans and doing Nazi salutes.
Yeah.
Meloni rejected this behaviour and said that there was no place for fascism in her party, but yeah, maybe this was one of the many things that made Rachele Mussolini decide, this party is not for me, it is too right-wing.
I get that it's like symbolically significant that the granddaughter of Mussolini would reject Meloni and the party. Like, it's a good headline. Do you think her quitting will actually have any real-world effect, though?
Yeah, honestly, I don't know if it's any more than just a good headline. She is, after all, just one local councillor in Rome, but
what a surname, though.
Yeah, what a surname. It is worth pointing out that she's very popular in Rome. She won the most votes of any candidate at the last council elections in Rome in 2021. And as you say, even if it is just a good headline and it's just of symbolic significance, that is still something.
Mm.
She's also not the only member of her family who has rejected Meloni's party. Rachele Mussolini's sister, Alessandra, is a member of the European Parliament representing Forza Italia also. And she's also been quite a vocal defender of LGBTQ rights. And some people have seen her as a bit of a thorn in Meloni's side in the European Parliament.
Interesting.
I do find it kind of a strange turn of events that the descendants of Mussolini seem to be forging a path as flag bearers of a slightly more moderate brand of conservatism in Italy right now.
Yeah.
Like, how did that happen?
And what would he make of it if he could see them now?
He's probably turning in his grave. On the other hand, Meloni's party is still polling in first place with about 29% of the vote in the average of polls, although it should be noted that the Social Democrats have been on the rise over the past 6 months and have made it up to 24% in the polls.
Hmm.
Anyway, even if this is all only a good headline of symbolic significance, I'm giving good week to taking a stand against Italian right-wing extremism. Is it going to dent Meloni's support at all? I don't know.
You know what? Let's take victories when they come.
Who's had a bad week, Katie?
I'm going to give bad week to the Schengen zone. Maybe you've heard about this already, maybe you haven't. But I think it says quite a lot about where European politics is right now. So I thought it was worth taking a closer look at this story. as of Monday, Germany has reinstated border checks on all of its land borders. Normally, of course, Germany is one of the countries in the Schengen zone, which means that if you're crossing from one country to another, you barely even notice that you're doing it, whether you're in a car or in a train or a bus. Nobody asks to see your passport, nobody checks your bags, which makes getting around a lot of Europe a hell of a lot faster for both people and goods. It means no customs inspections and stuff being transported from one country to another. And generally, when you ask people about Schengen in surveys, they're really positive about it. It's seen as one of the biggest achievements of the EU, managing to create this massive borderless area that is home to 450 million people and is also enjoyed by many non-European travellers, of course. This week, though, with Germany putting checks on its borders with Belgium, France, Denmark, the Netherlands and Luxembourg, joining the checks that were already in place on Germany's borders with Austria, Poland, Czechia and Switzerland, that has felt like a pretty big deal. This is Europe's biggest economy. It's a lot of different borders that we're talking about. And there have been many, many think pieces written this week over whether this could be the beginning of the end of the Schengen zone.
I'm glad you mentioned that there were already border checks on the border of Austria and Germany, because I've always been really confused by that when I get a night train from Austria back to Amsterdam and they wake you up in the middle of the night to check your passport. It's horrible.
Like, why are you doing this? Also, I was asleep.
But I guess now they're going to have to do that with a lot more countries. What a faff. Why are Germany doing this?
Well, Nancy Faeser, the German Interior Minister, she has said that these new border checks are going to limit migration into Germany and, quote, protect against the acute dangers posed by Islamist terrorism and serious crime.
Does this have anything to do with the recent elections in Germany?
It has everything to do with the recent election results. So it's been about 2 weeks now since the AfD came top in the state elections in Thuringia, the first time a far-right party has won an election in Germany since World War II. Those elections came just a week after this terrible knife attack in the city of Solingen. A man killed three people, and the suspect is believed to have had links to the Islamic State group. He was also a rejected asylum seeker. So Olaf Scholz's government, they're under a lot of pressure to look tougher and be tougher on migration. And that is especially the case given that there are more state elections due in Brandenburg over the weekend, and the AfD are again polling in first place ahead of those elections. So it could be another really quite momentous win for the far right in Germany. So that's the context. Whether putting these checks on the borders will actually change much, that's another question. We're recording this actually quite early in the week. It's Monday evening. So it's not clear yet how much disruption this is going to cause. For at least some of Germany's borders, it looks like it's just going to be random cars being checked, which you could argue is great. You know, it means minimal disruption to people trying to just go about their day. You could also argue that, well, doesn't this just mean that this whole thing is just pointless political posturing? How does migration come into it? The thing that could change now is that there is potentially more chance of an asylum seeker getting turned back at a German border. We've talked a lot in the past on this podcast about something called the Dublin Regulation, which is this rule that means that if you're an asylum seeker, you are supposed to claim asylum in the first European country that you enter, right? And you probably remember that back in 2015, when Angela Merkel famously welcomed asylum seekers to Germany during this huge wave of migration from Syria and Afghanistan and many other countries, at that point, Germany was basically saying, to Syrians at least, you know, we don't care about this Dublin rule. If you can make it to Germany by crossing other European countries, it's fine. Come here. That era seems to be well and truly over.
Yeah, it feels like a lifetime ago.
It really does. A lot has changed since 2015. Of course, not everyone in Germany welcomed the people that arrived as part of that wave with open arms. And not everyone has welcomed the roughly 1 million Ukrainian refugees that have come to Germany either. I don't want to make it sound like Germany has had a totally open policy between 2015 and now, because it hasn't. I mean, just this year, for example, apparently 17,000 people have already been turned back from German borders. But what is changing now is that Germany has signalled to its European neighbours that it wants to be much more proactive about sending asylum seekers back to other countries along the route, if it can do that legally. But none of the infrastructure for systematically assessing asylum seekers at the point of entry, with a view to sending them back along the route, none of that is really in place in Germany. And it often takes months to assess whether someone can be legally sent to another country or not. So what is Germany going to do now? Is it going to keep people in camps at these borders? something that would have felt quite politically shocking up until now, and still will, I think, if it happens. But we just don't know yet if it will. And we also don't know how many people currently just slip into Germany and then claim asylum or simply stay below the radar. So it's really hard to know if these new border checks are going to change that. There are a lot of unknowns.
I know our new far-right and right-wing government here in the Netherlands are actually quite excited about this news, because I think it's like giving them the opportunity to think, oh, maybe we can do this too.
Mm-hmm.
But what are all the other Schengen neighbours thinking about it?
Most of them are not very happy about it. So Luxembourg, for example, is asking whether this is going to cause huge traffic jams on the border. Austria has said it's not going to take any asylum seekers that get turned back at the border with Germany. So that's potentially going to cause a huge political row down the line. And Poland's Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, he has gone so far as to accuse Germany of endangering the entire Schengen project. So I think it's fair to say that apart from maybe your government in the Netherlands, Dominic, it hasn't really gone down that great with the neighbours.
Playing devil's advocate for a moment, how much of a big deal is this considering there are already some Schengen countries that have border controls in place?
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, I think it is worth asking whether Tusk is right and whether what Germany's doing is endangering the whole project or not. There are actually 8 Schengen countries that currently have internal border checks in place. And this is really something that started with this huge wave of refugees arriving in 2015. And then there was a second wave of restrictions that came during COVID. A bunch of governments shut the borders then, you might remember, hoping to stop the virus spreading across. There have also been more since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine over worries that the open borders are making Russian intelligence operations easier. And more lately, Gaza has been used as a justification for needing border checks over here in Europe. Generally, the justifications given are national security, terrorism, and the need to control immigration. And on that front, actually, it is worth noting that asylum claims have gone up in Europe lately. They did fall during COVID, but there were more than 1 million claims across the EU in 2023, which is the highest since 2016. Anyway, regardless of how these restrictions are justified, they have indeed been in place over quite a few countries a lot since 2015. But in general, they are supposed to be temporary. However, they do keep getting extended. And you get the sense that there has been this general acceptance growing across a lot of Europe in recent years that these kind of checks are basically here to stay, despite what the Schengen zone is supposed to be, this borderless zone. Now, if you're someone who likes the idea of closer integration and Europe feeling in some ways like one big country, your instinct will probably be to look at this with dismay. But personally, I'm not so sure about it. Like, I think if you want to be an optimist, you could say, you know, Schengen is still broadly functioning. And if it is a case of Germany just saying, okay, our police are going to randomly stop some cars now, rather than systematically checking every single person and like everyone having to queue for ages on every border, maybe this is okay as a development. On the other hand, are we going to look back at the last few years as this time when our governments were like gradually chipping away at free movement? I think that is also a possibility. What I can tell you is that there are certain people who have reacted very positively to this latest move from Germany. One of them, you've already kind of referred to him, Dominic, is Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. The others are Marine Le Pen and Viktor Orban. All of these people have said, yay, this seems like a great move.
Mm.
Orban's response to this was, welcome to the club, which appeared to be a reference to the fact that Hungary for years has been criticised for its hardline stance on migration by other European governments, when these views are increasingly becoming pretty mainstream for governments like Germany's. There was actually a statement from Orban's spokesman that said, funny how a few years and a migration crisis can change minds, isn't it? So, yeah, I don't want to undermine your good week, Dominic. You say it's been a good week for fighting back against the far right. Maybe that's the case in Italy, at least. But I do wonder if this is yet another example of non-far-right governments adopting policies that have been advocated by far-right parties because they're scared of them.
I feel like you tricked me into taking good week. I actually wanted that to be bad week for Giorgia Meloni. And because you wanted to take this, I agreed to make it good week. And hey, here you are stabbing me in the back.
You fell straight into my trap. Well, we could rebrand this as bad week, worse week, but then it wouldn't be very cheery, would it? I mean, like I say, what does this mean in practice? If this is just some random cars being checked, it might not mean that much at all. Symbolically and politically, though, it does feel like yet another acceptance of this right-wing rhetoric around borders and migration, that we should be scared and we should instinctively fear people arriving on our borders rather than, you know, seeing what we can do to help them, and that we should be accepting as few asylum seekers as we legally can. All of those have become sort of much more mainstream talking points. So I think it does say a lot about what the political mood is like right now.
We're both stuck on the symbolism of these political actions, huh?
Maybe it's time to talk about testicles.
Let's talk about testicles after this quick message about our supporters. We couldn't continue making this show without the incredibly generous support of our listeners on patreon.com. Thank you so much to all the lovely people who financially support this show and mean that it can continue to be free at the point of use. This week, we'd like to thank a special new supporter, Cassandra. Thank you so much for joining us. You can join her by heading to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
When we were in Warsaw together in real life in July, we talked about all kinds of things. But one of the more surprising things that we talked about was we were talking about methods of contraception over dinner. I can't quite remember why. And you just said, Dominic, really casually, like, oh, yeah, there are all of these people who put like a big rubber band around their testicles and use that as contraception. To which I said, like, what? Because I had literally never heard of this thing. Do you remember this conversation?
I do remember this conversation. And I think maybe you've misunderstood how it works. It's not just putting a rubber band around your testicles. You put a rubber band, I think, around the scrotum, but you leave an empty sack because you have to push the balls, like, into the little bit of the body where they can, like, hide away.
Yes, it's this nice little hole. There's so much that I don't understand about the male body, so I'm glad that you're explaining this rather than me. You're doing a much better job.
Well, I think quite a lot of men also don't really understand how this works, and it's news to them that this is possible.
Well, it's good that we're talking about it today. Anyway, after you told me about this, I fell down a bit of an internet rabbit hole and spent quite a long time, but evidently not enough time, reading about this. Because as a woman, I am naturally very interested in forms of contraception that can take some of the burden off women for a change in preventing unwanted pregnancies. But I'll confess that it's something I've never really looked into at great length. And it turns out that indeed, aside from things like condoms and vasectomies that most of us know about, there has been a significant amount of research done into male versions of the pill and other forms of male contraception for like 40 years. A couple of products are in clinical research right now. But it is interesting that we still haven't really had a mainstream society-wide conversation about this. And there are a few different theories about why it hasn't happened. One is that women maybe don't want to trust men with the responsibility of doing this. Another one is straight up sexism in medical research. And it's just too normalized, this idea that it should be women who bear the responsibility of contraception, and that men also couldn't possibly be burdened with the side effects, even though women have been dealing with the side effects of the pill for decades. So there's a few different theories around why we haven't really talked about this as much as maybe we should have done. But don't you think it is about time that we do have this conversation, Dominic?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's ridiculous how much of the burden lies on the shoulders of women.
Well, I'm hoping that we can launch that wider conversation today, maybe just a little bit. Our guest is someone who has been using this DIY form of male contraception for 2 years now. So it's not like these products that are undergoing clinical trials right now. It's not a drug. It's what we talked about in Warsaw. It's this kind of ring thing that is made out of silicone, which our guest, Paul, made himself. And yeah, as you say, it tucks the balls inside this hand little cavity, which is right behind where they normally sit. How much do you understand about why this works?
Quite a lot. It's about temperature, right? The testicles need to stay at like a quite specific temperature. That's also why they shrink up and then get more loose naturally. Because regulating the temperature of the testicles for sperm production is like one of the most important things for fertility.
Yeah, I had no idea about any of this.
That's why lots of truck drivers who sit on heated chairs often discover that they've made themselves infertile temporarily.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that either. Maybe we should have interviewed you about all of this.
Maybe you should have.
But yeah, it's a form of contraception known as heat-based contraception, and it has been studied for decades, but certainly nowhere near as much or as thoroughly as the efficacy of a contraceptive method like the pill. We were really curious to hear from someone who actually uses this contraceptive method about how it works and why they decided to do it. And our guest, Paul Laborie, was the perfect person. He is a journalist and photographer based in Brussels. He wrote an excellent article about his experience with this form of contraception for Vice Brussels. So we gave him a ring to find out more.
Hi, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello. You're welcome. Thanks for hosting me.
So my first question is perhaps a bit of a childish one, but something that I'm sure a lot of people will want to know the answer to. How does it feel? Is it uncomfortable having your testicles tucked up inside your body for 15 hours a day?
I think 2 days after I started wearing the ring, I didn't notice. 95% of the times, I would say, I don't feel anything. And then sometimes if I did some sports or if I'm sitting in a train, moving, wearing bags, that kind of things. Sometimes it goes a bit off. I feel that it's not properly worn and I just go to the restroom. I put it on correctly and it's fine. So it doesn't feel like anything, actually.
I'm glad to hear you're not correcting it in the middle of a train.
No.
Just out.
No. I like to keep some things private, so yeah.
Good for you. What made you decide to take the step of using this kind of contraception in the first place?
It's mostly different circumstances. Like, I heard about it for the first time maybe when I was 18, now I'm 25, and I heard about it in sociology. The question was how it would be possible to have a screen contraception, how it would be manageable to make it available for everyone, but it was actually not a solution that the scientists would be putting forward. 2-3 years after, I was studying journalism and one of my friends did her thesis about masculine contraception. So I read her thesis and I thought, yeah, okay, so that's still something. I didn't really think seriously about it. I've been single for really most of my life, so the question wasn't relevant for me. Then when I was 23, really randomly, I was walking at the beach with a friend. There was a surf festival and we met a guy with a great style, Muay Thai shirts, shiny jacket on the beach. And he was saying, yeah, I'm doing a workshop about crafting contraception rings for male. Takes half an hour, it's free, and you can leave with 2 rings and then you can try. So we thought yeah, okay, of course, let's try. And it was quite funny because it was on the beach and we had to try different sizes of rings to know which one we should make for ourselves. So we ended up trying rings in a crowded restroom in Biarritz Beach with the smell of piss and shit and everything. So it was a bit underground. Yeah, so we did this. And then I met my girlfriend. So I thought, well, okay, now I'm going to start to wear it because it's easy. It's cool to know I can control it. For me, it was a good thing to be able to rely on myself. Then there is also the fact that doing this relieves a bit of the burden of contraception that's commonly held by women. And then there's also a practical thing that my girlfriend has some kind of health thing that makes that the other options are not really suitable for her. So this ring was the best option, and that's why I tried it.
And you've been using it now for quite a while, as far as I understand. How do you know that it's working?
Yeah, I've been using it for 2 years. Well, I know it's working because we don't have kids, for sure. And before wearing it, you have to do a sperm analysis to know what's your sperm production like. So you do the first sperm analysis, then you start wearing the ring, then you wait 3 months. 3 months after, wearing it 15 hours a day, every day, you do the second sperm analysis that will allow you to see if it's working or not. So during those 3 months, it's not working. You can't rely on it as a contraception. But after the 3 months, I made the second sperm analysis and yeah, it's working.
And if you decided you did want to have kids, how complicated would it be to become fertile again? What's the process you'd have to go through then?
Yeah, you just have to stop wearing it. And I think it takes from 3 to 6 months. And then after 3 to 6 months of not wearing it, you are back to the, let's say, the normal levels.
You're obviously really open about the fact that you're doing this, Paul. I mean, you're here on a podcast talking about it. So thank you very much for being this open about it.
You're welcome.
What has the response been like from people around you, your friends and your family?
I'm open to talk about it on an article, on a podcast. It's like, let's say, a bit formal. There's a frame behind it. But then in my family, I only talked about it with my mom. And she was like, oh, wow, okay, that's great. Okay, tell me if it works. I didn't know it was something. It's great that you do it. Wow, nice, okay. So she was very supportive, and she still is, actually. With my friends, I talked about it sometimes, but then, like, not many people tried it themselves. Even though I was telling, you know, it's very easy. There are people who will help you build a ring, and it's really doesn't cost a thing. It's very, very, very easy. I think even though it's okay and they are like, yeah, great, okay, super cool thing, it's great that people do it, they will not necessarily do it themselves because it's not part of the culture. And I think for lots of people, I think it's just a matter of habit. Like before doing sports, you were not doing sports, or before driving, you were not driving. Then one day you tried, but before you tried, it was not part of your life.
You mentioned when we were talking about this before that getting a medical prescription to have your sperm count checked has actually been quite difficult. How have the doctors you've spoken to about this reacted to it?
Yeah. I think that's a great illustration of how it's not part of the culture yet. That was the struggle. Like, honestly, I don't go to the doctor normally. So then one day I had a nosebleed for a few days straight, and I didn't know why. And I thought, oh, maybe it's not normal. Okay, I should go see the doctor. It was the same week I started wearing the ring as well. So I thought I will just go to the doctor, ask him like 3-4 questions. And then, yeah, I started to talk to the doctor. And at some point I say, look, I'm doing a thermic contraception thing. I have to have my sperm checked to know if it's working. That's all. I'm just asking for a paper. And the guy was like, what's the thing? It's bullshit. No. There is no scientific thing. I never heard about it. He was really like demonizing the thing and saying that it was a complete mistake. So I started to get a bit angry. And I told him, look, there are some research. It's been 40 years that people are researching it. It exists. More than 10,000 people do it in France every day. I mean, it's working. It's something. You are the doctor. I'm not going to do your job, but like, do your research. Like, think about the other people that will maybe ask for it after me. And so he got a bit angry. I just left and I didn't have the prescription. So the first experience was very disturbing with the doctor. And then after it was okay. Even in Brussels, 2 weeks ago, I went to see a doctor and he just made me the paper. And he had some patients who were also doing the same method. So it wasn't a strange thing for him. He was not telling me that it would be dangerous or something. Just like, okay, you need a paper. If you want to talk about it, I'm here. That's all. And that's all I need. I don't need more.
Is there anything else you wanted to say, Paul?
Yeah, like when it all started, we talked about it with my girlfriend, of course. And she said, like, it's very nice that people are interested, and it's very nice that you do something about it on a big media like Vice and that you can talk openly about it. But then on the other end, it's a bit sadly funny that we put the highlight on something that some guy do while the women have been doing it for, well, I don't know, decades, centuries, I don't know exactly. So I got paid to write an article about it. Like, I don't know if many women get paid to write articles about taking the pill or something, you know, so this is some kind of privilege. So it's some kind of like a small revolution, but it's a very small thing compared to all the things that we could do and that women are bearing.
Want this interview to start a revolution? It feels like such a society-wide blind spot. Like, Paul is the first person to acknowledge that there should be more research done to confirm that this actually works and is safe. But if the complaint is there's not enough research, we should just do the research, no?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think, sadly, it's probably unlikely to go mainstream because men are just going to complain about, I don't know, feeling emasculated or thinking that it's going to be a bit painful. That's the sad thing about it.
Oh, men. Get it together. Stick your balls inside yourself. I am also curious about why this has taken off in France and Francophone Belgium a bit more than anywhere else. And I feel like it's a bit like the nasal douching thing There's this like rebellious kind of counterculture streak in French medicine, maybe. Like, maybe people are like slightly more willing to challenge the orthodoxy. But then you tell me that the nasal douching thing is actually very mainstream, so maybe I'm talking rubbish.
Yeah, sure. From nasal douching to hiding your testicles away in your body, you come to the Europeans podcast for all the important news stories of Europe. I think we should move on now, Katie.
I think so too. Thank you so much to Paul for joining us. In the notes to this episode, you will find a link to his website along with the excellent article about heat-based contraception that he wrote for Vice Belgium. You'll also find the website of Samuel Flambard. He's the guy who runs the workshops that teach people in France and Belgium how to make these devices. And if you're curious or if you're skeptical, it's quite a good source of resources to learn more about this kind of contraception. Check it out. Let's head to the inspiration station. What have you been enjoying this week?
I finally got round to seeing the Danish film Another Round.
Have you seen it? Oh, great film. I think this was my inspiration offering a couple of years ago, even.
Yeah, probably. I'm sorry. I had an inkling that that was the case. And I am a bit embarrassed to recommend it, seeing as it came out in 2020. But maybe, like me, you missed it. And this is your reminder to give it a go. If you don't know what it is, it's a film by Thomas Vinterberg with an amazing central performance by the Danish movie star Mads Mikkelsen, who just has the most fascinating face. It's about four high school teachers who decide to spice up their working lives by experimenting with keeping their blood alcohol level at 0.05% just during their work days. And the thing I really loved about it was that it's not moralistic about alcohol. It is, of course, as you would expect, dark and has some very sad moments, but it's also funny and light and joyful. And I really enjoyed that about it. And I guess it's also why it went on to win the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film back in 2021. I'm very late to the party, but it's available everywhere at the moment. So I think wherever you are, you should be able to find it on some streaming service or another.
Never too late to watch this film. I love that film so much.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I'm also going to Nordic land. I watched a completely mad documentary that was recommended on Mastodon by a listener, Stein. It's called The Goldspång Miracle. And oh my God, what a crazy film. It was made by the Swedish documentary maker, Maria Fredriksson. And it's one of those documentaries where you find yourself thinking, like, wait, this can't actually be a documentary. How did she manage to witness this entire thing? This can't be real. But it does seem to be real. I don't want to tell you too much about it because it's more fun if you get to discover all of the twists and turns yourselves. I'll just tell you that it's about two Norwegian sisters who walk into an estate agent in a Swedish town, very far from where they're from, and something very strange happens. And then a bunch of other strange stuff happens as the film goes on. As Stein put it, he said, one is left with more questions than answers in a good way. And I would totally agree with that assessment. Stein was struggling to find a place where you could watch this film with English subtitles. But there's a reason that Mastodon is my new favourite social media platform, because another listener, Rafa, chipped in and managed to track it down on the BBC. So you will need some kind of access to the BBC to be able to play it. I won't tell you how, but I will post a link to it there, as well as a link where you can watch this film in Denmark. It's definitely worth your time.
I'm really intrigued. I really want to see it. But I will wait until I'm in the UK and have access to the BBC iPlayer.
You are a good boy.
Time for a happy ending. And following on from my Good Week segment last week about screen time, I thought I'd share a happy news story about smartphone abstinence that crossed my path this week. There's a restaurant in Alsace in France called Petit Plat de Mamama, and they banned mobile phones in their restaurant a year ago. This month, they released news into the world about what effect this has had on their business. And whilst you might think that all of us phone addicts would be put off from going to their restaurant, in fact, the ban has had a positive effect on the business. They are claiming that the policy has, in fact, led to increased sales and profits. apparently people are ordering more desserts and staying longer at the restaurant because they end up wanting to talk more. And when people are not allowed to look at their phones, it turns out we all actually do still have things to say to each other.
Oh, that is lovely. I'm also really happy that it's just been good for business and that people are eating more desserts.
Yeah, it's really nice, isn't it? And it kind of goes against the conventional wisdom that restaurants should be encouraging people to take photos of their food and put it on Instagram, and that's how everyone finds out about it. I was quite pleased to see that the lack of Instagramming at the dinner table seems to have been totally fine, and I just found it very cheering news. That's all we've got time for this week.
It raced by, didn't it? You're actually away next week, aren't you, Dominic?
I am sadly busy rehearsing with a schedule that meant I couldn't join you, but you'll hold down the fort, I'm sure.
I will, with the help of our wonderful producer in Warsaw. Wojciech is going to be here keeping your microphone warm while you're singing your little heart out. I'm curious, how many of our listeners do you think are going to go and tuck their balls inside themselves after listening to this podcast?
I honestly think some will, and I hope that some will.
Please do, and then report back. You know where to find us. hello@europeanspodcast.com.
This episode was produced by Morgan Childs and Wojciech Oleksiak. Thank you both so much.
Thank you to them, and thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Tschüss.